Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
And as we're recording this, we have lots to talk about, but this is, we're recording on Tuesday. It is the day after the debut screening of one of the final puzzle pieces remaining in this awards season, which is Babylon, Damien Chazelle's epic seems to be the actual apt word to describe it. So really, first things first, David and Rebecca, what was the vibe like at this anticipated screening of Babylon? I assume the energy was pretty intense. Everyone's really been watching this one closely.
Oh, yes. It was, I think there's one screening every season where I feel like I'm running behind and it's going to be totally packed and I'm not going to get in because everyone has been waiting to see it all season. And I definitely had that feeling this time. And the screening was held at the Samuel Goldwyn, which is the Academy's theater with the big Oscar statues like looming in the corner. So it definitely had that buzz about it as we went in.
Yeah. And it was packed. And there's a long line snaking around Wilshire Boulevard as you arrived, and they had a reception after for a few actors in the movie.
Which actors? Because, I mean, we'll get into this, but, like, in the size of the sprawling cast, I think it was really hard for anyone to know who, besides Margot Robbie, Brad Pitt, and Diego Calva, were worth noting from this.
Giovanna Depo is a highlight of the movie and was definitely mingling among the crowd.
Mm, okay.
Yeah, it seemed like Diego and Jovan were, you know, definitely working the room and also getting a ton of attention and a lot of photos, requests.
Didn't see Tobey Maguire.
But Brad Pitt and Margot were there, right? They were at the Q&A.
Oh, and Tobey was at the Q&A. I just mean, once it came to the mingling. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't expect Brad Pitt to try to walk through that room.
No.
So what are you guys allowed to say about Babylon? I know the reviews are embargoed. Richard, you still haven't seen it. I haven't seen it either. And I think that you're allowed to react vaguely, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think talk about its awards chances, which obviously get into, you know, a little bit of what we thought of the movie. So we'll be careful. But anyone who gauged the reactions out of the premiere can know, it's going to be a tougher sell than certain Damien Chazelle movies have been in the past, I think. It comes in at over 3 hours without credits, just over. It has some incredibly wild tonal swings. Damien Chazelle remains an incredible craftsman and visual artist, and so I think you'll see the movie really compete below the line, which should help it above the line. But yeah, I think it's going to be a tough sell for an across-the-board campaign beyond, you know, getting a couple of nominations.
Yeah, I think what we noticed at the event afterwards is this movie is too bold and vulgar for maybe the traditional Academy voter who loves a Fablemans or a sort of classic movie structure. You know, there's a lot of nudity. There's a lot of I don't even know how to describe this.
There's a lot of nudity.
I've seen tweets about animal excrement.
Yeah,
lightweight.
There's there are scenes that I definitely like winced watching, and obviously it's on purpose, but I feel like there's a certain type of voter who's not going to be okay with that. And so beyond that, obviously that's not the entire Academy at this point. I feel like this movie is just going to be very polarizing. So there are things I definitely loved about it, you know, especially the first half. But I just, yeah, I wonder how it's going to sit with people beyond the crafts, as David's saying, because the music is incredible. The, you know, the costuming is really, really, really stands out. So I think the big question is definitely above the line.
Where does it stand on the line between Hollywood hagiography and Hollywood takedown? I mean, is it reverent? Is it a satire, or is it somewhere in the middle?
I think one interesting thing about Damien Chazelle making this movie is he remains a real sentimentalist, but he's also, especially early on, reveling in the hedonistic sense of debauchery of the era. And there are moments when he really chooses not to shy away from the ugliness of the period, but it is still ultimately basked in a nostalgic glow, which I think that tension is something that's going to be talked about a lot, especially by critics, because you feel some competing impulses there. The other thing I would say is that it definitely would not be wrong to call it a comedy, and for the Golden Globes to categorize it as a comedy, and that a lot of that goes into the fact that he, you know, lampoons a lot of, you know, the way films were made in the era, and the ridiculous senses, you know, the ridiculous focuses on timing and, you know, innovative strategies to get things right when the technology wasn't there. So that's all mined for a lot of comedy and silliness. Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we all know that he's such a cinephile himself, and he knows so much about film history. And I think, not that I wanted this movie to be longer, but not
Rebecca.
The characters don't get a lot of backstory, and I think that's because he's assuming you know that they are based on real Hollywood stars, you know, and so you know Anna May Wong's history, you know Clara Bow's history, but a lot of the audience will not know that, and I felt like you didn't hear anything about any of these characters' backstories, and I do think we would have probably felt more for them if they had done that.
Yeah, I think that's a lot to ask. And Brad Pitt's character is inspired by John Garfield, right? Is that actually? Yeah. So, like, yes, that's someone whose, like, name I sort of knew, but I think I looked him up, you know, ahead of this movie, because he was a silent star who didn't make the transition. And the familiarity of even people like us with silent movies is often very limited. That's an interesting tactic.
It's just big. It's just such a big movie.
It's so big.
Yeah.
There were a couple people I spoke to at the reception who were looking forward to this movie as the fun one of the season, because it is, you know, a lot of the strong contenders are not so fun necessarily. And, you know, for a good chunk of the movie, it feels that way, but it doesn't leave you with that in any way. And I think that seemed to be a sentiment that I was encountering a lot at the reception.
We had some questions throughout the past few months about Jean Smart and whether or not we should be leaving a slot for her in supporting actress. How do you guys feel having seen that movie now?
Well, unfortunately, you know, in the Q&A, they mentioned that the first version of this film was 4 hours long. And so it sounds like a couple of maybe her more significant scenes got cut. And so you definitely want more time with her, but I don't see it being enough for a part of the supporting conversation.
Yeah, given the shape of the category, I honestly don't think she has any kind of path. She has one lovely scene, but beyond that, it's 3 hours long. So, you know, she's not someone who's making the big impression there.
Who was her character based on?
There was discussed. It seemed like she was drawing from a lot of eras and periods in this particular one, because the moderator had asked about Hedda Hopper, which is obviously a different era. But there is.
Oh, so she's not an actress. She's playing like a journalist.
Yeah, she's a gossip journalist.
And apparently, well, there is the character writes a big profile of Margot Robbie's character, but in this movie, the final cut, you don't you just kind of see the profile come out. And it, from what I gathered, a big part of her arc in the movie that was that did not make the final cut was about her writing the profile with Margot Robbie.
Wait a second. So if she wrote a profile of Margot Robbie, is she not playing Rebecca Ford?
It's me, guys.
Plug.
On newsstands now.
Your fabulous headgear that you wear every week for this podcast has finally made it onto the screen. Oh, I'm so glad.
If only I had the style of Jean Smart in this movie.
No, but we should talk about Rebecca and Margot Robbie and your profile of her, because, you know, Rebecca, you had seen some of Babylon before writing that piece, but you hadn't seen the whole thing. And, you know, your profile of her, the cover of Vanity Fair out now, really treats her as this kind of force of nature, both behind the scenes and on screen. And it does sound like that comes through in Babylon as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, for the cover, she walked me around the Paramount lot where they shot a lot of this film. And you could just tell that this character was something really special to her. And you can see why. I mean, she really delivers. It's an extremely demanding performance. Like, that character, Nelly Roy, has to be sort of at an 11 the entire film. And she really delivers it. And I think you're going to remember that performance no matter how you feel about this film. So, you know, it was really great to hear her sort of, her process for finding a character is really interesting. She does a lot of animal movement classes and things which you can read about in the profile that I found totally fascinating and could totally see them when I watched her on screen.
So with Margot Robbie, I believe we're looking at the Best Actress category, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
How are we feeling about that after seeing Babylon?
I think it's in the same category as how you think about Olivia Colman in Empire of Light, another movie about movies that is
such
is
a different movie.
But, you know, like, it is another movie about movies that I think will meet a fairly mixed reception, fairly divisive response. And in this case, like with Olivia Colman, Margot Robbie's giving a really big, powerful performance, you know, fairly undeniable. But it's to me, a question of how well the movie does and how much it resonates and how far it goes, because I think part of what the direction of the movie and the direction of the character is perhaps what will lead some to not loving this movie necessarily. And so I don't think she's a lock, but I think she's, you know, she's fantastic in the movie and she's absolutely in the conversation.
So here's the thing that I don't think I'm the first person to bring this up, but when you guys talk about a movie being too like big and vulgar for the Academy, I think of The Wolf of Wall Street, not just because Margot Robbie's in it. And that movie got 5 Oscar nominations, including picture director and 2 acting nominations. Does that path feel viable for Babylon, or is this even more wild and divisive than that movie?
I think it's viable. I mean,
yeah, I think it's possible.
Yeah, I think that's the model, especially of modern, you know, movies of more recent of that that quality. It does seem that Wolf of Wall Street came in, from what I remember, pretty divisively, similarly, and kind of eked it out in the end. DiCaprio was not even a sure thing for a while there in Best Actor, and slowly but surely it built enough steam. So yeah, I think that's the model for a movie like this. But I also think that movie was so in conversation with, you know, Scorsese and his style and what he'd done. And I think that's where part of the admiration came from. Whereas this felt like a big departure in a lot of ways for Damien, and in other ways, a real continuation of what he's done so far. So it's a different kind of swing for him, I suppose. And it depends on how voters take it.
I do want to, I don't unfortunately think they'll be in the conversation for awards, but I do want to point out that Javon Adepo and Lee Jun Lee both really, I thought, had really strong performances in this. They're both too brief, but anytime they were on screen, I couldn't take my eyes off them. So it was nice to have those moments. It's just with this big of a film, you just don't get enough of certain characters.
Do you think, I mean, without spoiling anything, obviously, do you think that there is like any obvious controversy lurking with it? Like,
I was just going to ask about that.
Is there going to be a backlash against it? Is it going to offend people? Because it sounds like it's taking a lot of swings. So I'm just kind of curious if you think it has to navigate like tricky water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It does. That's one we probably can't say too much, but you know, there were a few scenes that were already being talked about that I think will raise some eyebrows.
Well, even last week when I talked to Sam Wasson, the co-author of Hollywood, The Oral History, like, he hadn't seen the movie, but was kind of pushing back against this idea of early Hollywood as being a Babylon at all. You know, there was the famous Kenneth Anger book, Hollywood Babylon, that contained a bunch of stories of wild behavior in Hollywood that's been debunked many times over the years. And I think even the notion of presenting Hollywood as being this, as opposed to like a town where everyone's making 50 movies a year and is on set 14 hours a day, I'm kind of looking forward to that controversy, honestly. That seems like, if we're arguing over silent movie star is great.
It's funny, Katie, because I was thinking of your interview, especially the first 30 minutes of the movie, because I had Sam Wasson saying in my head, it's not true, it's not true. And then it's like this insane opening set piece of unhinged old Hollywood antics. So yes.
I mean, it does seem like Damien Chazelle is not trying to be like, this is a documentary about what early Hollywood was.
No, I think that, and that definitely goes to the fictionalization of the characters and the fact that he is making up the world to some extent. While it's greatly informed by backstories and real people, that is a real emphasis of the movie, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I did an interview with the costume designer, Mary Zofries, recently, and she said, like, it was forbidden to even consider, you know, flapper outfits or actual looks from the period. And the same with Margot mentioned about the way they speak. Like, they were not trying to, you know, be historically accurate when it came to that part of the depiction.
Well, Babylon's not actually in theaters until December 23rd. We have a ways to go. But, you know, Critics Awards, Golden Globe nominations, Critics' Choice nominations, those are all coming around the bend. So I guess that's the next real gauge of how Babylon's playing outside this room. And then, Richard, you're seeing it in New York this week as well. So it's making its way across the coast.
Yeah, it's a screening in New York on Wednesday. Have no idea when a review will be up. I'm assuming somewhere in December. But they wanted people to see it before critics' votes. You know, like, New York Film Critics Circle is in, like, 2-3 weeks, so...
Yeah, this is the time of year when time gets kind of flexible. Like, a December movie is out now, and the conversations are all over the place.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works. Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Well, David and Rebecca, you guys were talking about Babylon being kind of anticipated as the fun one, and it made me think about Wakanda Forever, of all things, because that is another, you know, huge movie that we've been anticipating at the end of the year. It's now open in theaters, but as has been discussed, it's a little bit of a downer in a lot of ways, especially for a giant Marvel movie. I finally saw it. I know we talked about it to some extent last week, but now that it's out, now that it is a pretty big hit, and a solid critical hit, I would say, like, not on the level of the original Black Panther, but I enjoyed it a lot, despite having some of the same reservations as some critics. And it just made me wonder if we should revisit that briefly. Do we feel more bullish about its chances of being, you know, the second Marvel movie to get a Best Picture nomination now that it's a full-blown hit?
I think it certainly has momentum, you know, in a way. I mean, it was always going to. It's a big, heavy object entering the atmosphere at speed. But, like, yeah, I think the reaction is not as effusive as it was, you know, in 2018 when the first one came out, but also, like, how could it have been? You know, like, it's very rare that a sequel, even something as heralded as this, outpaces its predecessor. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that I think the big question is, like, how much, like, does it have legs? You know, like, obviously it'll do well this coming weekend. It'll keep making money, but, like, what kind of money are we talking about? Is this going to be a phenomenon, or is it just something to tide people over through Thanksgiving and then the next big shiny thing comes along and
Avatar.
And, Yeah, I mean, Avatar is looming with its version of blue people riding whales on the in the water. So I don't know. I'll be curious. I think that weirdly the movie has sort of soured more in my estimation the longer I sit with it, and I'm wondering if that'll be the same for other people.
I'm pretty skeptical of its chances to crack Best Picture, honestly. I might push back Katie a little bit on the framing of how it's done critically, because from what I've seen overall, it seems more in line with a lot of MCU releases that don't get much Oscar traction. And I do think that's partly a product of high expectations, obviously.
Yeah, you're right. Honestly, I was just looking at Metacritic. It's at 67. I had thought it was higher than that. So pushback accepted.
It's a ton of movie, and there's a lot of, you know, wonky MCU stuff that I just do not see a lot of Academy members going for.
And you're saying Julia Louis-Dreyfus isn't organically integrated into the action of this movie?
I love Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I, as someone who has not kept up as much with the MCU, as I would guess is true of a lot of Academy members, I was like, what is going on here?
Yeah, she had been in the Marvel Universe before.
Little did I know.
But wasn't the big thing when they were announcing Disney Plus and all these Marvel shows, I feel like maybe I'm remembering wrong, but like, didn't Kevin Feige or someone say, don't worry, you won't need to watch the shows to follow the movies? And then they kind of quietly backslid on that, where it's like, yes, Julia Louis-Dreyfus does appear in the post-credit scene in Black Widow, right? And which, like, a movie that came out at some peak of the pandemic and there was a Scarlett Johansson suit, the studio over it. Like, you know, like, I don't know how memorable that was. And then, she's on the show. And so, I don't know, it feels like it's... And then you have this other kind of backdoor pilot for the Iron Man successor, I guess she's supposed to be.
The Iron Heart?
Sure.
Nice, Katie.
Metal Girl? I don't know.
I liked her, though.
No, she's great. But, like, what is it doing in this movie? You know, I understand why it's there from a business perspective or a synergy perspective. But I think there is enough, like, brand maintenance happening that the first Black Panther was just a standalone. I mean, yes, it had some connective tissue to the other stuff, obviously. But, like, it really stood on its own 2 feet very sturdily. And this one is, I think, in some ways cynically relying on a meta-textual grief to push it into that awards conversation. And I don't know how successful they'll be at doing that.
Mm. Yeah.
Here's two things I will say that I think makes the Black Panther movies, both of them so far, kind of stand apart. They cast really charismatic actors and have them be charismatic, which all the other Marvel movies tend to, like, have charismatic people. And you're like, oh, they are plugged into this place where Paul Rudd makes his quip and then someone else does another thing. You know, every time a new actor shows, like Winston Duke and Letitia Wright and Lupita Nyong'o and a cameo that I guess I won't spoil still, you're so excited to see them and they really kind of fly off the screen. And then the other thing is that it just looks incredible. Like Ruth Carter and Rebecca, you talk to her, like her work, they took my breath away every time a new character walked on screen. And I think we haven't doubted that crafts are strong nomination potential for this movie. But I think it makes it something that you kind of need to see or hopefully feel like you need to see, even if the rest of the Marvel Universe doesn't appeal to you. So I don't know if that would get Academy voters to get over their skepticism about the, like, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus part of the storyline, but it might, they'll at least see it and kind of appreciate the visuals that are spectacular.
I also think we're getting to the point where we're not dealing with that many spots that are probably still open for the Best Picture 10. I mean, maybe it's almost time to start talking about what that list is, because
give us your 10, Rebecca.
No way, I'm not going first.
But it's just My Policeman 9 times, and then one other.
Then the whale.
Yes, I do love the whale. I do think we're probably talking about three or four spots for, you know, 10 films that we're still talking about. So, I mean, we're waiting on Avatar, and that's kind of it at this point. So,
yeah,
it's almost time to. But I think that's. For me, that's the bigger issue with Black Panther, is there are only a few spots left and a lot of films that I feel like could be ahead of that to make the list.
Yeah. And in terms of the big movies, you know, I ask, do you think that Babylon or Wakanda Forever are in over Top Gun Maverick or even Elvis? And I think the answer is no.
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually got a listener question about Elvis this week from a listener in Australia who couldn't use subtext. So I was so happy that that he had a direct route to us. And he said it feels like Elvis has become a guaranteed Best Picture nominee at this point, which I like wasn't totally sure I believed. But now you guys are making me think that's actually true. Like, it's in.
The Elvis Whisper campaign is real. I was in, I was covering the Napa Valley Film Festival over the weekend, and there are a lot of Academy members in this, in that area. And that was a movie that kept coming up. And I was honestly taken aback. I wasn't searching for that. And I hadn't been hearing that a lot until that point. But it's a movie that a lot of people love and that made a ton of money, you know, speaking of success, and made a ton of money as an original movie from a director who absolutely put his stamp on it and made it instantly recognizably his. I think it's looking pretty strong. I mean, I don't think it's a lock yet because it was obviously not particularly well reviewed, but I think it's totally in that conversation in the same way that Bohemian Rhapsody was.
It's kind of amazing because I feel like, you know, we're being sort of swamped by certain films right now, and it's Elvis has been so quiet. But I think you're right. Like, people, it's almost sort of like, oh yeah, and Elvis will be in the top 10. And I'm like, we're just assuming? We're like, it's just it definitely seems to have that current behind it somehow, which is really interesting.
The one other thing I wanted to say about both Babylon and Wakanda Forever is, to your earlier question, Richard, about Jean Smart, I think there was a lot of eyes on both her and Angela Bassett mm-hmm. for potentially disrupting supporting actress. And it just still feels as unformed and chaotic and kind of fascinating as it did before those movies bowed, because I just don't think we have a front runner at all.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't like gone back and looked at it in a while, but it still is like some combination of women talking, Carrie Condon, and you can kind of start taking some guesses from there.
Carrie Mulligan.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah. Jamie Lee Curtis, Stephanie Hsu, Tuso Mbedu, and then, you know, Angela Bassett. I'm looking at Gold Derby. A lot of people are putting in for her. She really is phenomenal.
She's great.
In Wakanda Forever.
Yeah. And then she's like, has a significant role in it. You know, yeah. She's not just in a couple scenes as the queen. She's like actually involved in the plot in an integral way. And that I think counts for a lot. I mean, because there are so many great performances that could fit into that category, but it's like, ooh, I don't know, like how many people from Woman King would they look right. at, you know, for that or whatever other, or, you know, even She Said, which like, okay, like they're running Zoe Kazan in lead and Carey Mulligan in supporting. So you think, okay, there's your supporting, but there's also like Jennifer Ely and Samantha Morton. And, you know, mm-hmm. like I obviously like a campaign has to pick its horse and say sorry to the other ones. But like, I don't know, maybe there's room for some sort of like actual supporting performance surprise. I don't know.
Yeah. The fear of a situation like this where it's so disparate is that you just get like two women talking nominees, two everything everywhere nominees, and then Claire and Carrie Condon, and that's it. And I do think that's a possibility because it's so hard to narrow this down.
Doesn't it make you think of the year that Tilda Swinton won, where like a different yes. person won supporting actress at every
Amy
award
Ryan,
show?
Ruby yeah. Dee, love that category.
That was a really, really fun year. Worth noting, I think, is that Glass Onion premiered or had its LA premiere. It had been at TIFF already on Monday night, the same night as Babylon. I don't know how close across town they were from each other, but it seemed like a real battle royale. So I wonder about Janelle Monáe and how that movie might kind of start ramping itself back up in this category and everywhere else.
And speaking of Napa Valley, Janelle Monáe was in Napa Valley, She won a Trailblazer Award there, and I moderated a Q&A with her. And she stayed basically the whole day and was talking to everybody and seems to be really enjoying the moment. And Netflix is really pushing that campaign. But yeah, it is a case, to your point, Richard, of she's the very clear awards push of the movie. But sometimes if you're the only one, it's not quite enough. I think we'll see how far that goes.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out how it fits into Best Picture also, right? I think we've all gone back and forth, you know, knowing that the original Knives Out didn't make it in there. Like, is the sequel going to do it? Maybe, you know, a sequel issue similar to Wakanda Forever.
Yeah.
The biggest takeaway I heard was that people want Kate Hudson to be on the next season of The White Lotus, kind of playing the same character.
It is really just wild to have The White Lotus airing at the same time as, you know, Glass Onion coming out. They are so, such a spiritual handshake between the two.
And Triangle of Sadness, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And The Menu, which we said we were going to talk about, but maybe we'll get to shortly. The Eat the Rich theme, not literally in The Menu, I'm not spoiling anything, but it really is a theme of this season.
But by saying you're not spoiling that, you're spoiling
that may have been a spoiler.
Well, speaking of The White Lotus, which if you want to hear more about, you can hear Richard and Chris on Still Watching talking about every week. And we'll get to it at some point. But I did want to talk about television to wrap this up because Fleischman Is in Trouble premieres on FX this week. I still haven't read the book. I think I'm the only person who works in media who hasn't. So I feel like I need to give this over very quickly because everyone else says it's great. Tell me why it's great.
I haven't read the book either, Katie.
David, please explain why the book is good.
Oh, wow.
And the show.
Richard, you want to talk about the show?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't read the book. I will say, as an endorsement of the show, it made me want to read the book. You know, it's based on the novel by Taffy Burdesser-Ackner that's, you know, about a 39-year-old-ish, 40-ish man who is in getting divorced. He's played by Jesse Eisenberg. Claire Danes plays his ex-wife. Lizzie Kaplan is narrating with a lot of text I think is lifted directly from the book because
yes, it is.
Taffy did her own adaptation. And it's about him being newly single. He has kids. He's navigating the wealthy wilds of the Upper East Side. And that's kind of a big part of the show's fixation. And the first episode is really just about this guy, Toby, discovering like Tinder and other apps that straight people use. I mean, I use Tinder, don't worry. And I was just really kind of put off by it because I was like, well, these are straight people problems. I don't care about any of this. This is boring and weird. And I've seen way too much of Jesse Eisenberg's ass, frankly.
Back to the rich people problems of The White Lotus, right. Much more relatable.
Right. And then as the show goes, and it's my understanding, obviously, that this is how the novel works, too, is that you have Lizzie Kaplan narrating and you know, with each successive episode, her character, who is kind of a stand-in for Taffy, she's a, you know, magazine writer, kind of semi-retired, living in suburban New Jersey. And she starts to move toward the center of the show in a really interesting way. And Lizzie Kaplan is amazing in it. I want her to narrate anything I ever write. And then it becomes this really mournful, wistful meditation on like middle age. And yes, these are all very rich people problems that these people are having, but like, it becomes this kind of existential thing that there's a moment in one episode toward the end of the run where I was like, this is almost like enlightened, like the way that it's kind of this dreamy musing about life and, you know, your experience in the world. And it really got me in a way that I did not think it would. And, you know, Claire Danes is amazing in it. Jesse Eisenberg is, you know, kind of a take it or leave it proposition, I find, as an actor. And he works in this role. But yeah, it starts rough, at least it did for me. So if people have that same reaction, I would say stick with it.
I find that reaction really informative because I have read the book and, you know, I was surprised at the beginning how faithful it was to the book, mainly because I was wondering how it would fare on a week-to-week basis for people watching it because, you know, the structure of the novel is really canny and very much about subverting your expectations. But it works differently with a show where you're, instead of, you know, reading a chapter every night, you're watching an episode every week. So that's going to be the challenge, I think, for the show, because it doesn't introduce itself as the kind of really smart and empathetic and deep show that it is. But that's kind of part of its twisty appeal. I thought they did a great job with the adaptation. And if you like the book, it's a very faithful and smart take on it.
It really does recreate the feeling of reading a novel. You know, it unfolds over these seven episodes. It jumps between characters, but keeps it all in sort of cohesive memory. Like you're aware of where everyone is, unless you're not supposed to know where someone is. And then, you know, there's a satisfying reveal later on. It feels very substantive and like like a satisfying meal. And, you know, some books just have a shaky beginning or something. You're kind of like, I don't know if I'm really into this. And you just have to kind of press on a few more chapters and then it gets you. And that's what Fleischman did for me. And in a way, you know, look, I don't really care about this doctor who makes $300,000 a year complaining about money, you know, okay, cool. You know, but like, I think the show and I think I'm assuming the novel is aware of that, you know, to some extent. And so as long as there's a little bit of self-consciousness about the very rarefied world we're walking in, I don't know. I found something, maybe it's just because I'm about that age and like whatever, but it really struck a chord with me. And again, I can't stress enough, like Lizzie Kaplan, this is like a different, like this is a whole different level for her as a performer. And I think she's definitely someone to watch for, you know, Emmy stuff or whatever else.
Yeah, she's kind of remarkable. I mean, I was pretty blown away by her work, especially in the back half of the series.
I've just started the show. I've only watched two, but I hadn't heard anything about it until we all started talking about it internally. And I know it's going to be a Hulu release. And I don't know if that was just me being in the Oscar bubble, but I feel like this is going to be sort of a word of mouth show situation, unless I'm just, just not tapped in. But I feel like it sort of came out of nowhere for me. And it feels like one of those sort of breakout hits.
It is hard to assess, because like Katie said, like it was a very media book because Taffy's from that world. She's a great profile writer at GQ and she did stuff at the Times. And so I can't really fairly assess it because it's like everyone I know knows that book. And like I went to the premiere party for it and in New York and it was packed and it was like every media person you've ever known in your life was there. And like, and that was obviously a deliberate invite list, yep. So, but what we care about or what we know about, obviously does not always translate to what other people care about. So yeah, Rebecca, I am curious, like if people like stick with the show and then start recommending it, if it kind of could have a sleeper status.
How are we feeling about Jesse Eisenberg being middle-aged at this point? Having been an adult when The Social Network came out, I feel a little stressed about it.
Yeah. There's actually a joke in the show where someone is saying, like, oh, you should go into tech, and Jesse Eisenberg's character says, I don't have enough hoodies, which I thought was cute.
Back now. John Fetterman revived them.
Right. He doesn't look... He still looks young, And there are times in the show because he's, playing opposite Claire Danes, who is older than him. And, they're both great together. But like there are times when you're like, but this is just a kid. What's he talking about? Jesse Eisenberg really is 39 years old.
I know. I was shocked when I looked it up. Yeah. I felt the same way about him as I did about Lizzie Kaplan. I thought the casting was really clever in the way, because Adam Brody's also in a pretty pivotal role in terms of the, amalgamation of these characters. But he felt like, it felt like he was peeling some new layers too. And it was kind of fascinating to watch all these actors who you've watched since they were teenagers, in a lot of cases, play grownups and kind of wrestle with that. It felt very intentional to me because Lizzie Kaplan, of course, falls into that category, as does Claire Danes.
Does anyone know where Adam Brody's house is? Because there's some sort of fountain of youth in his backyard. Like, he looks incredible. And he's really good on the show. And I think to the Eisenberg thing, like, I think very smartly, the show lets that sort of petulant Social Network-y Eisenberg pop out a few times when you're sort of seeing a different facet of Toby's character, But for the most part, I think you're right, David, that he does... There's a warmth to his performance. There's a sort of a gentleness to it that you don't always associate with his work. So, it is exciting to see him really step into this expansive grown-up role.
Yeah.
Well, Richard, you mentioned Emmys, but we actually have a lot sooner to look for some awards for this kind of thing because the SAGs and the Golden Globes are both coming right around the corner. And these TV awards are always really fun because you get to put in a lot of new shows, like the current season of The White Lotus. The Bear will be eligible for awards. So we can really kind of get excited about that. And then by the time the Emmys come around next September, we'll be like, oh, Fleischman, I don't want to talk about it anymore. But now it's fun and new.
Yeah, I think it could do well at both of those awards.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. Rebecca, you'll have been to the Academy's Governors Awards, yet another high-profile Academy-adjacent event on the calendar full of them. So you're excited about that, I assume, right?
Yes, my pre-Thanksgiving event. Super excited.
So we'll talk about that and more next week. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter, for now, at HWD and on our own. I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield, 97.
And Rebecca.
Rebecca M. Ford.
You can also email us, as our Australian listener did, at littlegoldmen@vf.com. We really do love hearing directly from you. Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of next year's Vanity Fair Oscar party goes to David Canfield.
Unhinged old Hollywood antics.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.